Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 18, delivered on April 1st.
Tonight, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. This is, again, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. This is sort of like one of the foundations of modern finance. Developed many decades ago, it is a very simple formula. It's nothing that blows you away, although working out the details of it might be a little bit stressful. But all you need to do is know this capital asset pricing model and know what it can do for us. Specifically, it can give us an expected return to a stock or to a portfolio. It can even be used for getting the discount rate for a project. It is an all-purpose formula. It was quickly embraced by the finance community. However, when there were attempts to apply it in industries and in the real world, it was not particularly well received for a long time. In fact, even courts threw it out as just theoretical mumbo jumbo for some years before it was finally understood, this is how we do it. Now, there have been some models since then that have attempted to sort of jump over and say this is a better way to predict expected returns than CAPM, the capital asset pricing model. But none of them really has shown itself to have the enduring strength of the CAPM. Moving to some of the specifics of this, give me a second. Let me get some coffee in me to get this rolling. Oh, this is nice. Got my cabinet right here at home. So we'll start with a couple of things that I get a running start from where I was on Monday night. On Monday night, I brought you to this place where I showed you this sort of real-world thing, data representation we've had seen for so many times, and so many people have rerun this and seen this same thing. If we look at individual stocks and even small portfolios of stocks, we will see different risk levels versus rates of return. Here we're measuring risk in terms of the standard deviation. And I'm going to talk about a couple of other measures of risk, one of which is huge to us, beta, but there are still other measures of risk that are used as well, specifically coefficient of variation, the Sharpe ratio, and a few others. But anyway, for now, all we're going to do is measure the total standalone risk of a stock against its return. You can collect the data on literally hundreds of thousands of stocks and bonds and portfolios, and you'll see them all over, scattered all over the place as far as risk versus return. And again, I almost heard something I care about. Really? There. Risk. Putting up a stupid whiteboard on an old wall. Let's try that again. Mess with me, will you? I'll show you how to do that. There. Where the hell was I? Okay. Let me bring this down just a little bit. See if I can adjust this without having the webcam fall flat. Seriously? This is one of those webcams that's got a clip instead of a good mount. Grr. Okay. And you see this thing that we've got right here. Let me get this as close as I can to you so you can see it better. All of these data points scatter out, but there's something curious about all of these data points. And we can just do a few more out here at very high risk levels of the stocks. But anyway, and actually, you could type into Google and you'll get lots of this, the same picture. But the thing is that what we do see is that there are no data points above a certain region. This thing right here, this place, this boundary, is called, this is an envelope in physics and engineering. It's called an envelope, but it's seen all through nature. This boundary where we'll never see an event above this boundary, whether it's a mechanical engine, a star's size versus its heat level or its life expectancy, we'll never see an event above this level in many things. And in stocks, it's the same thing. We see this boundary, this envelope. And in finance, we call this the frontier of efficient investments. The frontier of efficient investments. We'll never see an investment above it. So any portfolio you would see right there on the frontier, we would call efficient. It would be an efficient frontier. Practically speaking, we won't see it. But the theoretical possibility of it is something that we are very interested in, because then we can talk about how closely any given portfolio gets to that perfect place. So, for example, the whole point of investment in a professional way is to create a wide diversification of the portfolio. And the better the portfolio does this, the more fully it gets rid of the risk that is unnecessary, the closer it gets to this boundary here. Truth be told, on the boundary, if you took an investments class from me, I would tell you, okay, now you can buy these ETFs. ETFs are stocks that are actually a whole pile of stocks that are brought together to represent a single stock. Like, you can get an ETF for the Standard & Poor's 500. You can get the E-mini. You can get ETFs. And there are mutual funds that have just lots of different stocks in them. And those stocks and those portfolios are pretty darn close to the boundary. Now, in an investments class, I'll say, okay, you could do one of those, and you've got darn good portfolio diversification. You're as close as you can get to the efficient frontier of investments. But you could actually get even closer if you can put together a couple of highly diversified portfolios. They, taken together as a single, what I call super portfolio, can get you really close. You're not going to be on the boundary, but you're really close. The boundary itself would represent a portfolio of every stock in the world. And each stock in this portfolio would be in the portfolio. Dream on. I'll teach you how to be like me. You take stupid risks, you get decent returns, and then you have enough to buy a cheeseburger. But, okay, now, the thing, though, is that you do have so many people who talk about, oh, this guy's a hero, or this woman is an incredible fund manager. Look at this return that that person got. This return is way up there. A really high return. Way up here. Well, yeah, that's a very high return, but look at that risk level that's involved in it. That person could have gotten the same return for a lot less risk. No one talks about the risk in these portfolios. And I've been enough of a jackass sometimes in these portfolio competitions where I'm a judge, where they're showing, well, I got this incredible return. I said, what was the risk level you took with that? Well, I didn't measure that. Well, you're not going to get any award from me. I'm not going to vote for you. You could have taken insane risk to get that return, and you could have gotten the same return for a lower risk. That's what finance is all about, finding the lowest risk for a given return. We are risk averse. Most of us are. Some of you might not be risk averse. You might be risk loving. You might, but that doesn't mean you're right. That just means you're a crazy mofo. No, we try to get risk down as low as possible. I brought this one up last time. A stock like Microsoft would be like right here. This is its risk level and this is its return. But you could have formed a portfolio. Microsoft could be in it. Microsoft doesn't have to be in it. That could get you the same return for a heck of a lot less risk. That's the whole point is, well, at the end of the day, isn't return all that matters? Yes, until you find out that risk bites you in the butt. Ask anyone out there on Wall Street today who's crying because all those years they took the risk and everything was okay, and then when the markets crashed, they found out that there's a downside to risk. Risk isn't always something you can pretend isn't there. It's like, for example, I told you that I run a paranormal hunting group at ISU. Wonderful thing to do. Now, on most hunts, there's nothing that happens. Maybe a whisper or something on our recorders, or maybe something you feel or you catch a glimpse of something. I've got a photograph up on Facebook somewhere of once we got an apparition kind of came in and faded back out and stuff like that. Okay, that wonderful. We're taking these risks, but, you know, nothing happens. We just have fun. And it's, you know, but there may come that one time when we run into a demon. And all of a sudden, I have one of my hunters walking out of the building saying, I am Satan's helper. I'm going to eat your dog. And that person has a really difficult time completing their courses because all the time they're looking at their tests and they're eating them and eating the professor and stuff. Okay, where the hell was I? Okay, look. Here in this case, look, you see this return to Microsoft, and I did this last time, and I'm just kind of catching you back up. MSFT, this is the return to Microsoft. Okay, so here is where you could have been, or at least close to that, as far as risk goes. Here is where the standalone risk of Microsoft on its own sits, parks. But you can see that there are actually two components to the risk. There's this risk right here, which is stupid risk. You didn't need to take that. You could have made that go away by diversifying the portfolio. But then there's this part of the risk that can't go away. That is the risk inherent to the markets themselves, inherent to the economy, inherent to the nature of investing in portfolios. So if you are just investing in single securities, you're bearing risk that there is no need for you to bear. So if you had efficient portfolios, and this is one of those things that you'll see in fact, in the investment places I am now, you'll see people who are holding one or two stocks, maybe three or four stocks. Oh, they just got potty trained. I mean, they are down so far, you could play handball on the curb with their stock prices. But the ones who had highly diversified portfolios, yeah, they got burned, and they got burned pretty badly. But they were medium rare, not well done. You see, because that risk, that unnecessary risk, bit them in the butts because they didn't need to have it. They were carrying it. It didn't bother them for all those years. And then all of a sudden, that one time, the demons come out, like that. Boy, this room is hot. If I had an apple in my mouth, I'd think I was at a luau. Where the hell am I? Okay. So I brought up the two kinds of risk. There is diversifiable risk. Diversifiable and non-diversifiable. I miss the boards at the college. They were big. Okay. Now, another word for the non-diversifiable. For the non-diversifiable. We call that systematic risk. Because it's in the system itself. It's not sitting on top. Think about it this way. You, sir, you have nodules when you get old. You're going to get nodules. We all do. And one sticks out here, and then one with some hair sticks out on your nose. I mean, I've got them. But you see, we can cut those off like that. They're non-systematic. They are not in the system. They are diversifiable. But if you have something wrong inside of you, you know, something like the COVID-19, that is in the system. That cannot be drawn out. Well, I don't know, maybe you reach in there. But it's in the system. So think of these as the nodules you can cut off. These are things down inside you. I smoke. I'm going to get cancer, lung cancer. That they just can't cut out. They're going to just say, boy, were you stupid? Die, fat boy. Another term here. Sometimes we say that the systematic non-diversifiable risk, we call that market risk. It's the risk of being in the world of investments. It's a risk you take by being here. And then on the other hand, the diversifiable part is sometimes called company risk. Because this is the peculiar risks of a given company that aren't characteristic of the market. So, for example, you could have a company that was run by very crazy people, but underneath it there is a fundamental company there that produces revenue, generates free cash flow that's positive, or is trying to. But what you don't want is to deal with the nonsense of that company and its peculiarities on its own. That's what creates that variability. But if you spread your portfolio out, that will cancel out with the oddities of other companies. It's sort of like, when you're alone, you are an arsonist. You burn buildings to the ground. But when you are with a lot of your friends and your family, you don't do that. You calm down. This is the same concept here, is that over a period of time, we will see company risks that you see when you look at that company on its own. But when you take that, pull back from that, and look at a whole group of companies, the weirdness of each company, or of some companies, will be suppressed by other weirdnesses of other companies. It's the same thing as in health insurance. Look, each one of us has peculiarities and oddities that make us sick at different times in our lives. For example, you, sir, I would say to you, okay, When you were young, you were not very healthy, but I mean, you got better when you got into your toddler years, and then you had your ups and downs in your teen years. In your preteen years, you broke a couple of arms and maybe a leg, and then you got into your teen years and you got into something that really caused you trouble. It's called girls, and then you got out of that, and then as you got into your 20s, you got a couple of influenzas and some, you ate bad food and all that. And then you go into your 30s and you are beginning to get a little bit obese, and in your 40s you begin to have diabetes, and then in your 50s heart disease, 60s, well, you know, it gets kind of rough as you get older, and then you die. Now someone else in this health insurance pool would have problems too, but not at the same time, especially if that person is of a different age or a different background or something like that. So as we add people to the health insurance pool, their peculiarities individually begin to get canceled out by each other. In other words, there is not perfect correlation between the among the participants in the pool with respect to their health problems. While you are having your first problems with heart disease, someone else isn't having those, but maybe a few years later, that person is having problems with diabetes. This is the whole point of that diversification. It's all through the universe. When you see in a choir, oftentimes, individual members of a choir are absolutely terrible, terrible singers. But when you put them all together, suddenly there's magic. When my kid was young, she said something horrible, horrible to me. She said, "Father, I want to play the viola." Oh my God, it was horrible. I mean, my cats cowered in the bathroom. And I had to go to the first concert, and I thought, oh, this is going to be really, really a Tylenol night. And so everyone was starting, when they were practicing to get ready, tuning up. And then when they started to play, it was awesome. It was magnificent. It was like every one of them had problems and squeaks and farts and whatever. But when you put them all together, it had symphonic beauty to it. That's what we're trying to do is in portfolio diversification. What we're trying to do is get the individual peculiarities of companies to cancel each other out. That's why when someone says, "Well, I'm going to invest in Tesla," are you on crack? No. I mean, the guy is baked all the time. He is a nutcase. But put Tesla into a portfolio and his weirdness will cancel out with some other company's CEO's weirdness. That's how it works. You're asking for trouble by investing in individual stocks. Now, you probably will. You're fearless. But as time goes on, and you have to be more responsible for companies' funds, for your family's funds, that's when you have to stop saying, "I'll take whatever risks. I'll take a risk out here to get this return." No, you don't have to. Just get a diversification into your portfolio. Now, how do I measure whether I'm doing well or not? Well, if you're buying individual stocks, you're probably going to get rid of maybe about 95% of this diversifiable, non-systematic company risk with about 30 stocks in the portfolio. Yeah, more or less. I mean, there's different numbers. But it's going to take a lot of stocks to get it to cancel out. And even then, you have to watch what you're doing. You can't just buy any 30 stocks. And I'll show you that in just a minute here. But that's why it's better for investors to buy index funds, index ETFs, like the Standard & Poor's 500. NASDAQ has an index fund. They all have them. Different risk levels on them, mind you. And mutual funds are the same way. Mutual funds, you can buy mutual funds that have a wide diversity of different things in them. And that can get you your portfolio diversification right there. And as I said, if you go for maybe three or four different ETFs and mutual funds, you've got darn good diversification there. Let me show you something. The whole thing about portfolio diversification, you have to put stocks in that are not highly correlated. If you have two stocks that are correlated, they're going up and down very similarly to each other, they're not going to cancel out much of each other's risks. That's why you want to find out for any given stock in your portfolio how it behaves against the other stocks in your portfolio. And I'll show you it right now. Oops, we got a Let's try this. I'm going to share a screen here. Now, what I'm going to show you, let me try it this way. Bear with me a minute here. Seriously. Once the meeting, I don't need to do that anymore. There. There's what I want. Share. Where I just pulled it up and now it's acting like it doesn't. Oh, there it is. Okay. What I'm showing you here is Portfolio Visualizer. And I'll put this up in the scrolling marquee on the sidebar at isu-prof.com. What this lets you do is put together find the correlation coefficients of a bunch of different stocks. So by ticker symbol, I can put in some stocks and see how they correlate. What I'm looking for is stocks that don't correlate well with each other. Now, correlation coefficients, which you probably remember from from your statistics course, they're between 0 and 1. Actually, between negative 1 and 1. But we're looking for something that is more along the line of, my rule of thumb is, you want correlation coefficients below 0.3. So I'm going to put in a few. And for example, let's Netflix and chill, NFLX. Anyone got a suggestion? Just call it out. Anything? USB? Sweet. USB. What else? Ford, Kroger, Microsoft, Apple, did someone call out another one? Walmart, WMT. Okay, let's leave it at this and let's see how these are correlated. And the start date, I'm not going to worry about this. Monthly returns, 36 months, use that for the basis for calculating the correlations. Now, Excel, you can do these correlations in Excel as well. Okay, so now, whoa, decent portfolio. For example, Netflix is very poorly correlated with USB, Ford, Kroger, Microsoft, Apple, Walmart. In other words, Netflix is something that you could put in a portfolio with these and it would cause no trouble at all. U.S. Bank. Oh, U.S. Bank, you do not want to put that with Ford. Do you see how high that correlation coefficient is? That's 0.52. If I've got a threshold of 0.30, and again, there are some 0.25, 0.4, whatever. But in my book, that is a nasty one right there. So I would not put USB and Ford into the same one. But U.S. Bank against Kroger. Now, against Microsoft, that one is a little higher. Sometimes you can figure out right away why two are related. That one's kind of leaving me a little bit like, why are they so correlated? But, you know, that's just the numbers. USB would be good against Apple. It's right on the boundary with Walmart. Now, Ford against USB, we already saw. Ford against Kroger, great. Ford against Microsoft, it's on the boundary. I can find so many other things. I don't need to do that. Against Apple, Walmart, great. Now, Kroger is just a sweetheart against anything in this. You see how Kroger is one of those that you could put into a portfolio with any of these, and it would not be a bad, it would help with the portfolio diversification, the cancellation of that diversifiable risk pretty darn nicely. Now, Microsoft, again, against USB, Microsoft against Apple, well, duh, that's kind of obvious why those two suckers are correlated. I would not put those into a portfolio together simply because they're not going to help each other cancel out the risk of the portfolio as much as I can do with a lot of other stocks. Apple, great with anything except Microsoft. And Walmart, you know, it's like Walmart is correlated with USB a little bit harshly. And I'm even worried about Kroger and Walmart, which kind of makes sense. That one is a little too close to my boundary for my taste. But like I said, you don't want to get stuck on these kinds of stocks that are, well, I mean, I just got to have this in a portfolio. If it's not going to do well with all the other things that you want to have in your portfolio, then dump it. Don't put it in there. Walmart's not going to care whether or not you have its stock in your portfolio. They're not going to have their feelings hurt because you are meaningless, as I am, to the body of their stockholders in the company. But anyway, this portfolio visualizer, and honestly, I still use it to this day to look at. Well, I'm thinking of putting this stock into this portfolio I have. As a matter of fact, I do this with mutual funds because in this plan that they have for me for if I ever retire, I have all I can invest in is mutual funds, and it's only 30 of them, for God's sake. So if I wanted to say which ones of those do I want to put together in this portfolio, this IRA, I go right here to the portfolio visualizer and I put in those mutual funds ticker symbols and I see which ones have low correlation because I know that those will help each other diversify the portfolio. The mutual funds themselves have diverse portfolio diversification, so I want to make sure that when I put two of these or three of these together, these mutual funds, I'm getting even more portfolio diversification, moving toward that super portfolio that's so close to the efficient frontier of investments. Okay, so there is that for us. Excuse me. Okay, now, the next thing here is metrics of risk. How do we measure risk? Well, there are emotional ways to measure risk. You can have, you know, if you suddenly feel terrified and you're going to die, you've probably seen some risk, but that's kind of hard to measure. We want something that's more numerical. And so the one that's kind of classic is the standard deviation. And then there are others. But before we do that, we would also want to talk about the expected return, because we really want to know the risk and return relationship that's going on. So in that regard, what we would probably want to do is find a measure of expected return. And that's pretty easy. You just take, if it's a large sample and every data point has the same probability of occurrence, you just add them up and divide by the number of points. In other words, in a sample of n, each one would have a weight of 1 over n. So you just say, add them up and divide the whole thing by that number of data points. If it's a smaller set, though, then it can be a little bit, you can assign specific probabilities to the different data points or the expected data points. Let me show you something here. Where the heck did I put my... Oh, there's my eraser. Ouch. Okay, look. Let's do something that is timely right now. Something that's happening right now. The unemployment rate for the second quarter of this year. There are estimates of this. We could have an unemployment rate that might, let's see, let's do it this way. Unemployment rate and the probability that that's going to happen. So we could have an unemployment rate out here of the lowest that we're talking about right now out here is about a 10% unemployment rate, and that has a probability of about 0.15 of happening. That would be a great thing. If we were able to keep the unemployment rate at 10%, that would be phenomenal considering what's going on. And then we could also have one that was 15%. Now that one has a probability of about 0.20. And that would be, And then we could have 20%, and that would have a probability of about, let's say about 20% as well, if I remember. And that would be OMG. And then we could have an unemployment rate of 25%, and that would be about a 35%, 0.35, and that would be our WTF scenario. That'd be Great Depression level. And that one has the highest probability. Now, in order to get the expected unemployment rate, we would take each of these 25% times 0.35 plus 20% times 0.20 plus 15% times 0.20 plus 10% times 0.15. Now, if that is sort of a pain in the butt, yeah, you can make a mistake, especially if there's a lot of data, a lot of points in the probability distribution. Now, this is a probability distribution because these probabilities add up to 1, 0.25 plus 0.20 plus 0.20. Now, in Excel, I'm going to pull up Excel and I'm going to show you a quick, dirty thing that we can do to work on this. I don't want to do that. I want to share a screen and I want to get over here. Share. Now what I'm going to do here, I'm going to put in those probabilities just straight up. And the unemployment rates, what were they? 10%, 15%, 20%, 25%, 10%, 15%, 20%, 20%, and 25%. Probabilities were what? 0.15, 0.20, 0.2, 0.2, and then 0.35. Now, in Excel, you could take this times this, plus this times this, plus this times this, plus this times this, plus this times this. But there's a formula, there's one of the functions in Excel allows you to do it automatically. You would say equals, and it's called sum product. You say equals sum product, and then you say, all right, I want you to take this column's elements, comma, this column's elements. And there's your Uncle Bob. The expected unemployment rate is going to be about 17.25%. So there's your expected return. The next thing is to find standard deviation. Now, standard deviation is a pain in the backside, especially if it's a clumpy distribution like this one is. Let me kill this for just a second here. And to get the standard deviation, you get the variance, and then you take the square root of it. The variance is going to be each one of the data points minus the expected value. So you're going to add up from I equals 1 to N. Each of the data points, those things, the R sub I, the rates of unemployment, minus the expected value we got, squared times the probability of that one. So I would take 0.25% minus 17.25%, square it, then times it by 0.35, plus 20%, the quantity 20% minus 17.25, square that, and then times that by 0.20, plus, et cetera, down the line. This is Excel territory. I mean, it gets to be way too much like boredom doing this, and it's easy to make a mistake. So use Excel for this. Now, taking it away from that and moving to the bigger issue, standard deviations are one way to measure risk. Another way that we can measure risk, standard deviation, that's a biggie. The problem with standard deviations in general, now if we're doing, by the way, if we're just doing plain old equal weight on each of the data points for n data points, just divide by n, we've got the function equals average in Excel. And we've got a standard deviation function, and I'll show you that one in just a minute here too. The problem is that standard deviation is not independent of scale. So in other words, I could have a company that had a huge standard deviation and a small of its net incomes or its returns or whatever. And I could have a small company that had a smaller standard deviation of its returns. But the smaller company is riskier because the standard deviation is measured against the scale of the company. So there's a way to fix that. We can use something called the coefficient of variation, CV, which is where we take the standard deviation and divide it by the expected value, the R, in this case, expected returns. So the standard deviation of returns divided by the expected value of the returns. This one takes out the scale. Let me show you this. I think I did this one before, but I'm not sure, but it's a good time to show it. I'm going to go back to this Excel thing, but I brought down the data for the Dow, since 75, the Standard & Poor's since 500 since 75, and the NASDAQ since 75. Now, their scales of returns are not the same. So I'm going to do something. First of all, I'm going to find the average, and that's always easy. That's that expected return equals average of all of these data points, these returns by year. Enter. Now the standard deviation. Here's a warning. And again, I don't recall whether I told you this or not. Excel allows you to do a lot of different standard deviations. Equals STDEV. Now look at all the ones that it's offering you. You see STDEV.P.S. Don't use those. Use the first one will be your sample standard deviation. If you just say STDEV and open your parentheses to give it the data, open your parentheses to give it the data, it will do the correct one, the sample, which is dividing by n minus 1 because it's just a sample. It's a little hard to explain what that is all about. But so I go, okay, done. This says, if it's a normal distribution, this standard deviation would tell us that there's a 67% chance in any given year in the sample that it will be plus or minus 14.98% away from here. In other words, minus is 14.98% and plus is 14.98%. Now I'm going to turn this into a percentage here. Format the cells, percent, okay. Now, let me do this. I'm going to take these two formulas and I'm going to copy them. I'm going to paste them here. Whoops, didn't mean to do that. I'm going to copy them and then paste them here and paste them here. Now, the problem though is, you see, that these standard deviations are not going to be comparable, because the returns of these three different indexes are not the same. But I can correct that by making the coefficient of variation, which would equal the standard deviation divided by the expected return. My backside, that's not supposed to be, okay. That's not supposed to be a percentage. The CV is not a percentage. It's a pure number. Just a number. Okay. Now, that's weird. Why did it do that? What did I do there? Let's try that again. Equals the standard deviation divided by the expected return. 1.5. Okay. So now let me copy that over. Copy. And then I'm going to paste it here. Paste and paste. And now you see something very important. If we look at risk and return, or CV and return, do you notice that the Dow, which is a very safe pile of stocks, has the lowest return and the lowest measures of risk? The Standard & Poor's, which is a riskier portfolio, big companies, but a lot more of them, has a higher return, but by either standard deviation or coefficient of variation, it has a higher risk. And the NASDAQ, which is where the little companies, the scrappy, risky companies are, it has the highest return, but look at that. It also has the highest risk. The classic risk-return relationship. The greater the return you expect, the greater the risk you must bear. that is timeless. And it's in all aspects of our life. You want a greater return? You expect a greater return? You take more risk. You all could have just quit at the end of high school and gone out and gotten yourselves a nice job at $8 an hour. But you didn't. You took the risk of going to college. A lot more expense in there. There's no guarantee you'll be able to get a higher paying job, but you expect it. Higher risk, higher expected return. It's all through the world, and it's in investments. And in investments, in fact, it is even sharper. The greater the return you expect, the greater the non-diversifiable risk you must bear. Again, the greater the return that you expect, the greater the non-diversifiable risk you must bear. And that brings us to the last. The measure of all measures, beta. The beta of the market is exactly one. We make it that way. And so everything is measured against that beta. It's a twist on the standard deviations and the correlations. It kind of blends them all together to get one comprehensive number. Betas below one are safer than the market. Generally speaking, betas above one are more risky than the market. And so we can find the expected return to any portfolio with this capital asset pricing model. The CAPM says that the return to a stock that we expect is going to be the risk-free rate, because everything has to pay the risk-free rate, or why would you take it if you couldn't even get what you could get for taking no risk, plus beta of the stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. We call this the market premium. How much more you get, the extra you get by taking the risk of the market over just going risk-free. And then beta is a scaling factor. It magnifies that risk if it's that expected return, that market premium, if beta is larger than one. It demagnifies it if beta is less than one. But this is what extra you expect, the market premium, for taking the risk of being in the market. Now, that was an awful lot like work. Let me stop this. Say that again? Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm still sharing my screen. Okay. Now, I have a quiz for you. It's 5 questions. It opens right now. And then after that, and it'll be open until 10:30 tonight, just climb into it. 5 questions, 15 minutes, and then you're done for the weekend, except for your homeworks or whatever you have there. But that's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.